Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and here with me, as usual, is Coach Chad Timmerman.
Hi, everybody.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And we are going to answer more of your coaching questions today, and you can submit them to us. Just go to trainerroad.com/podcast. You can also just use the hashtag on Twitter or Instagram. Just use hashtag AskTrainerRoad, and we'll pour through that every week and see what we can find. And you can find us on Snapchat and ask us questions there. We've been answering a lot of people's questions. Just send us a quick video or type it out, however you want to do it. We've been answering a lot of questions on there too. That's a quick and easy way. And we leak some stuff on there every once in a while too. Yesterday there was a leak about Android. So for all you Android followers or users, you'll be excited. So check it out. It's just Trainer Road on Snapchat. You can find it on there.
Will probably be gone by the time they hear this podcast.
I'll keep doing it. It'll still be there. It'll still be there. So for a bit.
Better listen right as this comes up. We'll keep doing it.
Go now.
We'll keep doing sneak peeks on it.
Yep. You'll get behind the scenes stuff. We'll even have tonight, like for example, at the Tour of California, we had a bunch of snaps there. So we were at stages 5 and 6. So we were at the stage that finished in Tahoe, and then we were at the Folsom TT. And we had a lot of cool stuff that we were privy to there that we shared via Snapchat. Tonight we'll be at the big Epic Rides Carson City Off-Road kickoff. It's like a big mountain bike race. Todd Wells, all the big pros will be there. And we'll have some snaps from that. I'll be trying not to die racing a criterium on a mountain bike, but we'll have some snaps there.
And that's on the road or dirt? I forget.
It's on road. But you have explain to use the
that?
Same.
Explain that. It's kind of cool.
So it's the Epic Ride series. They have like a bunch of different ones. Prescott, Arizona, and Grand Junction. They have some races. And the Carson City Off-Road is the new one this year. And for those that don't know, Carson City is like right at the foot of the Eastern Sierra. And right up the hills there is Lake Tahoe. So there are a lot of cool trails in this area. And that's really close to our office here in Reno. It's about 40 minutes away. So the way these races work is that they're usually really long. They're around 50 miles long, which is long for a mountain bike race. And that usually takes place on the pros for Sunday. And on Friday evening, they have like a twilight criterium with all the pros. And you have to race the same bike that you'll race the mountain bike race on. And the criterium is on, it's just like a normal road criterium. There's no dirt sections, no jumps, no weird things like that. It's just like a normal road criterium. So the only thing that guys do is you can run a tire. It has to be 35 millimeters or wider for the width, but you don't have to run the same tires. You can switch that out, but that's it. Other than that, you can't change anything on your bike. More pressure in your shocks and in your tires.
You couldn't like do a road bike and just take that up on the mountain bike course for 50 miles later?
I guess technically you could, but you can't have drop bars and you can't have any bars with bar ends in either race.
Oh.
So you'd be racing like a flat bar road bike. Probably wouldn't be a good bike for the mountain bike race.
Yeah.
So
how long would a 50-mile mountain bike race take for the pros?
The pros have 4.5 hours to finish it, and I bet they're going to finish it somewhere in between 3.5 to 4, somewhere around there, which is crazy.
Going pretty fast, yeah.
Yeah, this one, they climb from 4,500 feet about. That's Carson City. So what, like just under 1,500 meters, somewhere around there, if that's right. I may be off there.
What would just an age grouper, a normal person?
They have up to 8 hours to finish the race, and I suspect that the fastest guys will be right up there and not too far off from the pro times. So somewhere around 4 hours up to 6 hours. And for a lot of people, I think it's going to take full 8. Yeah, they climb from the 4,500 feet. They climb all the way up to, let me think, it's about 9,000 feet in elevation, so about 3,000 meters. And it's almost a consistent climb the whole way up. And it's like up fire roads. It's sandy in spots. It's like really deep decomposed granite, really steep. You get way up and you get to this point and you're looking down and there's a lake called Marlette Lake. And then there's like a short little chunk of mountain, and then it drops all the way down to Lake Tahoe, which is at like 6,200 feet. So you have like the most incredible views. It's a super cool ride. And the downhill trails that they take, they used to be the flume boxes that they would send logs down when they were logging and building all the mining towns. So like you're riding down those boxes, which is cool. So,
and then what's the purpose of the opening criterium? That's to seed riders for a 50 mile race.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah. So it's to seed you on the in the starting line, and it's also mandatory. So like you can't miss it. It's considered part of the event. But yes, you're right. The top, I think it's top five or top 10 pro riders get seeded. In other words, their call-up position on the line for the big mountain bike race is decided off of their finish in the criterium, which doesn't seem like on a 50-mile race, that's a whole lot, but the guys that are racing this are the best in the nation, and when the gun goes off, they go off really hard. It's not, even though it's a long day, they go off really hard in the beginning and try to get separation. You never know when you come across single track that's, you know, positioning is prime, so. But yeah, it's exciting stuff. So if you want to see more of that, check us out on Snapchat. You can find this podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. You can leave us reviews there. 5-star reviews are awesome. You can share the podcast, which is even better than a review if you've already left a review, of course. So,
I like both.
Yeah, they're both good. So, yeah, just spread the word. Let's answer some questions. Let's get right into it with Eric's question. He says, I've been a trainer road user since September last year, and I can feel I'm improving. I'm a new cyclist. I started last year, but I've been playing competitive tennis at a high level all my life up until the shoulder injury. So I'm a roadie now. The past 2 weeks, I've been getting dropped in my group ride. And analyzing my power data and the guys in the group, I noticed that I need to ride in the 200 to 250 watt range just to maintain the speed where the other guys in the pace line are riding in the 180 to 200 watt range. And they're heavier than I am, and I wasn't even pulling at the time. The good news is I'm able to continue my ride and ride for more than an hour and have an average power of 203 watts, so Trainer Road works. Here's the link to the ride, so he gives that to us, and we've looked at it. He says, he also drops a hint. This one's for us, Nate. He says, we should have the ability to upload outdoor rides to Trainer Road, hint, hint.
I know. It hurts me every day. We just need to get Android out and the Mac out. App out and get those all smooth and polished before we move into that realm.
We feel you, Eric. So he says, I just recently found out that my chain is completely worn, 3,800 miles on the same chain. When you take that chain off, Eric, you should frame it, have some type of memorial for it. It's lived a hard life. That's amazing that it's lasted that long. And it's worn down the chain ring as well. You should definitely expect that. He says, could a worn chain and chainring rob me of that much power? Am I not aero enough? Do I need aero wheels? Is there any other reason why I would need that many watts just to keep up with the group? Thanks for any help. Any help is appreciated, and keep up the great work, Eric.
Yes. this is really interesting because we just had a big conversation about kind of drag on your bike, mechanical, rolling resistance, aerodynamics at the company. And we looked at some, there's some fellow news articles about the best lube for your chain. And Jonathan, you want to talk about the best one they put in there, the top two?
Yeah, there's, so there was the, Molten Wax is the name of it, right?
Yeah, Molten Wax, which is, what kind of wax is that? It's just a,
it's like a paraffin wax.
Yeah, that you can get at a hardware store.
Yep, yeah. And the process to do that, it seems involved, but if you do it on the front end with a brand new chain, it does pay off. You don't have to lube your chain as much. It stays cleaner. It's also really, really low in friction, but it involves, you know, actually taking your chain and the wax and then adding some heat, quite a lot of heat, so that the wax itself can completely permeate all the different nooks and crannies of the chain. And then after that, you bring the chain out and you have to break off that wax and make sure that the chain doesn't have chunks coming off like that. But it works really well, and it stops stuff from sticking to your chain lube, because that's a lot of the problem. Is you'll get chain lube that works, makes things quiet, makes things smooth, but as soon as any dust comes around it, it sticks to it.
Yeah, so this article was comparing different lubes, and I think, what was the difference between the best and the worst? It was like 9 watts, right? Just on lube.
Yeah, it was impressive. I mean, if you think about that, 9 watts. Some of us try years for that to get that increase on our FTP.
And that's just one of the things that I want to talk about. So there's with the wax, and what the article said too, which is interesting, was to melt it in a small crock pot, because if you heat it up too much, it can explode or catch on fire. So if you're going to go that way with the wax, read about it. I kind of want to try it, just because what's been said is that it keeps your drivetrain very clean for a really long time, and you have to touch it between rides. And you could even kind of spray it off lightly with a hose and you're fine. The second one that was just like, I think it was 1 watt slower, a half a watt, was Squirt. And Squirt is more like a regular wet lube that you would use. And I think we should actually probably buy that for the office. I think that's going to be my go-to lube until I get the energy to use the molten wax.
I've actually got a few containers of it. It's I've liked it so far. I mean, I can't attribute any obvious power boost due to it, but you know, it's
well, your power doesn't boost. You just go faster,
right?
Because you're measuring at your crank.
Sure.
The other thing is your tires. So your tires, your tubes, and how you're running your tubes. We all like Continental 4000S.
What are they?
S2s, yeah. Those have a really good combination of rolling resistance, flat puncture, and cornering. But if you have like either an older tire or something like a Gator skin, or even you can look online for tire rolling resistance, and you'll see a page with a whole bunch of different watts or different tires and the watt differences in all of them. And right there, you can easily be 5 watts per tire with that. So let's say your chain is old, and I'm going to say your completely worn chain is going to be worse than this test did with a new chain with a bad lube, right? So I'm going to, let's say your chain is 10 watts easy. Let's say you have bad tires, 5.5, that's another 10 watts. Now, you could go tubeless, which normally reduces, depending on the tire, reduces rolling resistance. Latex tubes do too. A lot of people find latex tubes annoying because, one, they're hard to get. Two, they lose air pressure, like, so you always have to pump them up every ride, which I think is actually a feature because it makes sure you dial it in. But that can be about 2 watts per tube. So that could be 5 watts right there. So right now we've got you to 25 watts. And then you can do small things like, these are all marginal right now, but the getting the right width tire so it's aerodynamic with your wheel. I think Flow Cycling. You can go on their webpage, and they like the 23-millimeter Continental 4000 S2s, and they find that those had the best aerodynamics. Actually, Zip too with the Firecrests, they said the same thing. The 23-millimeter in the front with an 808, that was the most aerodynamic, even more aerodynamic than their tire, and they were going to try to improve on that.
And it's interesting because a lot of us think that you want to have a wider tire. We're all going wider on tires, but depending on the rim shape, like you said, Nate, that's the important thing. Like, without just considering the tire and its rolling resistance alone, but the way that it interfaces and treats the air and wind as it travels over the shape of the whole wheel as a unit, the rim and the tire, totally affects it. So that's the cool thing about that study that Flo did, for example, in Zip and the other brands, is that they actually looked at how the tire interfaces with the specific rim. So that's like a big thing that people forget about.
That's going to be hard to find data on unless you have a wind tunnel in your backyard. But so good luck with that. Other things, shaved legs, right? What did Specialized say shaved legs were?
I think it was something like 40 seconds.
I want to say it was like 10 watts. Like if you're pretty hairy, not super hairy, but like John's going to look it up right now. So now we're at what, 25, 35 watts. Now I'm going to say helmet. If you have, especially if you're a tall guy like me and your head's in the air, the difference between a like just a regular ventilated helmet and one of the new Aero road helmets, I don't have the data right now, but I'm going to estimate just for the sake of easy math, another 10 watts. So now you're at 45 watts, right? And then you have how tight your jersey is, right? Do you have like a really loose club fit? You see that on guys all the time. It's like flapping the whole time. Or you have something nice and slick against your body. And you know what? Everyone looks, when you're hunched over on your bike, your diaphragm pushes out. Everyone's got a little bit of a belly, right, guys?
Yep,
even
everyone.
Mr. 6.5 DEXA.
Yeah. Yeah, look. Well, I mean, look at Froome. Look at all these guys, even in the tour. You look at them and they're, you know, they've got their stomachs protruding too when they're down in that position.
Yeah. So. And no one cares either, so buy it tight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Am I missing anything?
In fact, that's like the biggest, in most cases, it's obviously not going to be the, consistent across everybody, but a skin suit, or at the very least, optimizing the way your kit fits, that can be a really big, like an easy grab for you to get a lot of efficiency out of that. So,
and everything I just named, go ahead.
Yeah. Specialized says that shaved legs save an average of 15 watts at the same speed, 79 seconds over a 40K TT.
I need to shave my
legs.
That's
a lot.
I just have these like 12-year-old calves, and I just look so skinny when I shave them. When some guys' legs like beef up and some don't.
So you guys fully geeked out on the hardware side of things, but there's a fair amount of, you know, quote unquote software considerations to make too. And that, you know, that's your body. So your position on the bike, if you're riding particularly high, I mean, maybe we're talking extreme aerodynamics here, but, you know, more blunt aerodynamics, if you're sitting taller than everybody else, or if you have wider shoulders than everybody else, maybe you prefer riding on the tops or the hoods instead of down in your drops. You don't have the flexibility for it, or you're challenging that flexibility and actually working against yourself and wasting some of your effort trying to ride harder than your flexibility really lends itself to. And then there's just raw efficiency, like mechanical efficiency. If you're a lumbering pedaler and you're basically wasting power, you're all over the bike, maybe you're in and out of the saddle. So there are other considerations, but basically to distill it down, you just want to ride as smoothly as possible. And you know, move about in the group as smoothly as possible, pull through smoothly, pull off smoothly. Things like that can add up quite a lot too.
Yeah, I know, Chad. I've learned a lot of this actually from watching and riding with you. Chad's extreme. So, Chad, how much do you weigh?
Right now, 170.
170. So you're not, in terms of cyclists, you're on the bigger side of things.
Yeah, and I'm typically more like 180.
Right. And I watch Chad when he's riding and he is so, so efficient. He's pedaling efficiently, and then he's making sure that he's always in the right line and he's saving energy, and he's really good at that. And that can go a long way. Let's say that you are an inefficient pedaler, Eric, for some reason, for one reason or another, maybe it's core strength, maybe it's just a you know, habits, something else. We can all be more efficient with it. But if you are, then there are a lot of things you can do, you know, strategically speaking, to counter for that higher power output that you may be using as well. Once you get the equipment down, once you start refining your technique, all of these things will come together, but you still have to make sure that you're putting yourself in the right position. I always tell myself when I'm riding in a group, like, I need to be more conservative than everybody else in how I use my energy. And I need to be more, I guess, just judicious with that. I need to make sure that I am being as efficient as possible in where I'm placed. So if I'm behind a rider and he's smaller than me and the guy behind me is a little bigger, I'm going to just sit out in the rotation just one more so that I can get behind that guy.
Yeah. People fight to be behind me.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to stay closer to that wheel in front of me rather than sitting 6 inches back. I'm going to get closer. I'm going to do everything I need to. I'm going to spend more time in my drops, and I'm going to focus the whole time. If you are putting out more power than everybody else, you're going to focus the whole time on belly breathing. We talk about that a lot, like in the workout text of our workouts, but not just using that upper portion of your lungs and your chest to breathe in and out, but using your diaphragm and your whole, you know, torso, your whole trunk is expanding and contracting when you're breathing. Doing everything I can to make myself more efficient. So if that is the case, Eric, that you are still putting out more wattage than everybody else, but if you're more efficient doing so, you're going to get a lot faster. So,
Another thing with riding in the group, I heard this advice right when I started riding, and it's so great. And I don't know how advanced you are, but hopefully some people can get something from this, is when you're drafting on someone, it's by feel, not by like the look. So you want to get behind them and you're going to move around until you feel like there's not as much air going on you, because it's not the best draft isn't always right, like tire to tire, right behind somebody, depending on wind and what the course is, like a little bit off to the side. You guys notice that too. You move over 6 inches and it'll be totally different, and you'll save 50 watts right there.
Always search for the wind shadow, wherever that is. Yep. That's where you want to be. Yep.
Yeah, totally. And then another thing to say about equipment. So all those things that I mentioned, the tires, the tubes, the lube, the helmet and the skin suit, those are things that, like, just when you buy, you know, when you buy lube, oh, I'm going to buy this squirt lube instead of the other lube, or when I buy a helmet, I'm going to get the aero helmet. That's not, like, the other two things would be, like, an aero road bike and aero wheels. Those are the really expensive things, and there's so much low-hanging fruit to optimize before you get there, before you spend, like, you know, $1,000 a wheel, or you spend $5,000 on a frame. And those aren't, you can get a bigger bang from your buck by optimizing those less expensive things that you have to buy anyways. Like, your tires are going to get worn out, so next time just buy the nicer tires. Maybe they're $20 more, $40 more, but you'll keep up for longer in your group ride.
Yeah, and one thing that you mentioned specifically, Eric, could a worn chain and chain ring rob me of that much power? It's interesting, when you get a brand new drivetrain, it's actually, it's not as efficient as when it gets broken in. And I'm using air quotes here. Of course, you can't see that. But when I say broken in, I mean, it's just that the surface of the chain and of the cassette and of the chain rings, they've come together. They've worn together, so to speak. When that happens, it'll operate more efficiently. Now, once it's really worn out like that and your chain has slop in it, and your chain is stretching, and then it's possibly slipping and grinding because the teeth are worn out on your cassette or on your chain rings, it absolutely loses a lot of wattage. You also get a certain amount, if your chain line isn't straight and everything is worn out, you're going to get some lateral shifting there, as in like the chain itself is going to be drifting more laterally than it would if it was brand new too. So yeah, definitely it could be, or it's definitely, I should say, causing an inefficiency, but I'm not sure if it, like we've talked about, there are a lot of things that could add up to making you more efficient. That's just one of them.
If anyone wants to know more about like the friction efficiency, there's a website called frictionfacts.com. It's friction-facts. You can just Google that. And for $15, you can get like a whole bunch of reports for them. And it's all about, you know, what's the best bottom bracket, the pulley, new chains, lube, all that kind of stuff to kind of optimize. I like it just because I can, there's many choices of what to buy next and they're pretty much the same price, but this gives me some data to pick the one that's going to give me extra watts.
And this is not sponsored. We just like that. So
Yeah. You know, no one sponsors us.
Yeah. There's one other website. Do. Yeah, that's true. bicyclerollingresistance.com. That's website that you can go to, and it has rolling resistance calculated for a bunch of different tires, even mountain bike and cross tires. So
Jonathan and I looked at that yesterday, and I had never seen rolling resistance for mountain bike tires, and I got to look in to see where their data is from, but
yeah,
two different tires, just one tire was 10 watts.
Yeah, pretty crazy.
I was like, they didn't have my front tire on it, but just 10, so that'd be 20 watts, and 20 watts, that's definitely the difference between first place and like eighth place, right, on a big long race. Crazy.
Yeah. Especially if you're riding in a place like LA, for example, and I'm sure there are other places like this, but this is the one that comes to mind. Los Angeles and Southern California, the dirt is like cement. Like there's no texture to it. It's just cement. That's it. And it's so hard that your knobs, that when you're rolling on it, first of all, you can get away with having a tire with a lot less, you know, a less gnarly tire, one with smaller knobs and with more knobs. But rolling resistance is going to be even more key then, because you're practically rolling on the road. It's such a hard surface. Whereas once you get into a normal mountain bike race and you've got the texture and different surfaces of dirt, those knobs are actually, even though they may decrease your rolling resistance, it may pay off in terms of traction. So it's a balancing act. Anywho, that's a lot of stuff, Eric. Let's move on to Chris's question. This question is from Twitter. He says, any tips for recovering from a broken collarbone? How should I keep fitness through recovery and gain confidence back in the group? So kind of two different questions.
Yeah, so let's approach or address each of those separately. In terms of fitness, mostly you're concerned with not losing the aerobic base that you built up. It takes a long time to build it. Fortunately, it also takes kind of a long time to lose it too, and not a whole lot of maintenance to keep it to keep it where you want it. So if you can get yourself on the bike pretty soon, and you know it depends on the severity of your break, whether or not you needed surgery or not, but most people, I see them on the bike no more than a week after their injury, a lot of them a couple days after their injury. So it's up to you to decide, you know, if you can get yourself on.
Indoor though.
Oh yeah, indoor. Yeah, absolutely indoor. If you can get yourself on the bike without, you know, still support yourself in a reasonably comfortable manner, obviously not putting any pressure on that arm, and then just do, you know, basically base workouts. I don't even know that I would ascend as high as sweet spot until you're good and ready for it. But stuff in the 60 to 70%, the traditional base sort of plans are a good way to get you on the bike, keep that aerobic fitness going, keep your consistency in place, and, you know, hopefully keep your motivation up and keep you from feeling discouraged.
Yeah, one thing about a broken collarbone depends, Chris, in your case, if it's plated. I've seen motocross riders with a plated collarbone, they break it, they get surgery, and the next day they're riding again. It's just with that plate, it can be really solid and it holds really strong. So whatever your situation may be, if they didn't plate it, it may just be hanging there and very much broken still. One thing I would suggest with getting confidence back in the group is I have the luxury of this out in our neighborhood out here in Reno. We have, I have a good friend, his name's Jeff Peters. He's in his late 60s and he rides every day, doesn't miss a single day. And in fact, Chad trains one of his good friends in that whole group too. So there are these elderly gentlemen that actually got me into cycling. And I go out and ride with them after coming back from a long time. They are so smooth riding in a group. They've been doing it for so long. They know exactly what they're doing. And it's a good way to kind of bring myself back into things. So if you know of somebody that is just that, number one, wouldn't mind you being a little shaky. Number two, is an exemplary rider, especially in a pack. That can be a great way to get back and get confidence in the group. One thing too is I would recommend, if you are a racer, Chris, or if you're looking to do anything like that, or even if you're just a group rider, I would work your way into things with smaller groups, getting into bigger, and also be a little more, pick the casual rides before going into a Hammerfest or a race.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. You want to pick smaller groups and slower paces and then just kind of ease back into it. And then there's going to come a point where it's just this mental obstacle that you have to overcome. And every new season, I spend so much of my time indoors. And then when I migrate back outdoors, I have to readjust to the group dynamic again. And it's downright terrifying at times. I mean, if you're bombing down a hill at 40 or 50 miles an hour, not a lot of separation between riders, that's outright scary. But I just remind myself, everyone out here has the same intentions. Nobody wants to crash. Nobody wants to crash somebody else. In all that aside, the more you do it, the more comfortable you get with it, and the more readily you recognize the skittish riders and the ones who are maybe a bit too reactive, grab their brakes a little too readily. You just kind of determine who you can and cannot follow. But mostly, it's just about experience, learning to relax, and gradually working back into whatever level you were when you left.
In general, I think it's kind of like when you get bucked off the horse, you got to get back on. If you do crash, just get back on right away and start riding. I had a fairly bad crash where I had like 7 stitches and stuff, and I had scarring on my elbow. And I think I didn't ride outside for, it was going into winter, but it was like 6 months. And then when I came back out, I was like, I don't want to ride outside anymore. Because my last experience was that crash. And now mountain biking, I crash all the time. My wrist, these guys know I jacked my wrists up. They still hurt like 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. And, but as soon as I crashed, I just was like, oh, I tried to like get on actually as quickly as possible. And the fear went away a lot faster, but I totally experienced that fear in chat. I do not want to go 50 down.
Yeah. But I mean, it's a continuous struggle. You never really get used to it. You just compartmentalize that fear a little bit better over time. But as I age and crash infrequently, less frequently, I just find myself gravitating more towards time trials and considering things like triathlon and the more individual, less mass start oriented stuff, simply because it's safer. And no matter how good a bikehandler you are, how comfortable you are in the pack, stuff still happens. So it's hard to deal with that psychologically and just try not to dwell on it.
Yeah. So to make everyone feel a little bit better, even our good friend Lance Armstrong, when he came back to the Tour de France, he said that he felt sketchy in the pack and he didn't feel comfortable. Like, and who has ridden in more larger packs, right, than him?
Right.
But he took a little time off and came back, and the downhills were scary. Just riding the pack was scary. After a while, he felt comfortable, but it's just a point of reference that everyone feels that way. And if you don't feel that way, I don't want you with my pack. You have no fear at all.
Right. So Chris sent in a question via Snapchat. He said, "Hello, Trainer Road. Love the podcast and your training app is amazing. I would never be as fit as I am without it. I was thinking that your training plans are great for the weeks that we train in building up for a race event. But when all is done and the season is over, I then stand in fear as I possibly watch my FTP and fitness slowly slip away. Are there any plans in the future where I can lightly train out of season without the fear of overtraining, but also without losing too much fitness or FTP? Thanks again, Chris."
Hi, Chris. There aren't necessarily plans to develop maintenance plans, but that's what you're looking for, right? You're looking to maintain fitness. And as I've mentioned numerous times in the past, it doesn't take a whole lot of work to maintain fitness. And because of this, I almost always gravitate toward low volume plans, the ones that have you training, a single hour of intervals, Tuesday, Thursday, and maybe a 90-minute weekend ride, or even an hour on the weekend, perhaps an outdoor ride. But it doesn't take much. Honestly, if you can do a VO2 max workout and perhaps a sweet spot workout, I mean, really any of the low volume plans to have you on the bike 3 times a week, most of those are going to suffice in terms of maintaining fitness, keeping your FTP from slumping too far, and in some cases not at all, depending on, you know, where you are and just how much you slip at the end of each year and how you drive your FTP. I mean, there are other considerations, but the fact is you don't have to do a whole heck of a lot to keep your fitness.
So in general, this question, is he asking, you know, let's say you have a 9-month season and then you have like 3 months where you're not going to go structured, and then after those 3 months, you're going to go back into like sweet spot base? Or is he saying, or is this question more of, you know, training is cyclical in nature, and at the end of your season, as you maybe take a week, if some people do this, you take a week or two recovery and then you start right back in at a new base plan and you go for your season. You know what I mean, Chad? Like the difference is there. I'm not sure if he's, what he's asking.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but same deal. I mean, in his case, he's just going to restart. So like we've talked about before, we just recommend a little bit of downturn, just the structure for a little while, enjoy yourself, and then get back into it. That's kind of a difference, though. We're rebuilding fitness from that point. So don't think that's what he's asking, but
one thing.
Yeah. So this is kind of, Jonathan, but this is kind of like what your advice is kind of the, if you have a long downtime before you want to dig back into it deep, right? Is that what you're saying? Because he doesn't want to have a long downtime where he does nothing and his FTP just falls, you know, 50, 60 watts.
Yeah.
And then he comes back.
Yeah. In which case, a couple rides a week are really all it takes.
Yeah.
And those couple rides that you could be doing in that downtime, Chad, that's, I mean, if you have a long time before you need to start getting back into actual structured base training, then moving into a build and then specializing your training for an event, that could be a good time to focus on or to address your physical limiters or in any other respect, right, Chad? I mean, if
it
you noticed
be, yeah.
the season before.
Yeah, I mean, if you have the motivation to do that, absolutely. I mean, I approach this as it's the end of the season. The last thing I want to do is bury myself with hard interval workouts any more frequently than I absolutely have to. But if you're looking to ride very little and maintain a fair amount of fitness, that's kind of the nature of it. You're going to have to do that a couple times a week. I mean, there are other ways to skin that cat. You can just, you know, ride a lot. You can focus on, as Jonathan stated, limiters and whatnot. I mean, you can do it a whole number of ways. I just approach it from the, what's the minimum amount of work I can do such that I can do other things basically and still keep a lot of my fitness so that I'm not starting basically from scratch at the beginning of next season.
And when we say limiters, we're talking about the holes, so to speak, in your training program. For example, if you've noticed that you really struggle with short, hard efforts, or you really, really struggle with sustained efforts or anything else like that. That's what we're talking about when we say limiters.
Yeah. And not to throw a bunch of, you know, kind of bland coaching terms at you, but there's strengths, weaknesses, and then limiters. And all limiter is, it's a weakness that actually limits you from racing the way you want to race. So you might not be good at sprinting, but if you're a long course triathlete, that's not a limiter. It's just a weakness. But if you're a long course triathlete and your muscular endurance isn't top notch, that's absolutely a limiter and something that you could perhaps address during these little downturns.
Yeah, and some of those things could be not just physical too, but tying in also to the mental aspect of things. Maybe it's a technique thing or something else. This time that you have that doesn't require you to be fully focused on just building up your power for something, you could be building up technique or anything else like that, mental ability to focus, whatever it may be. So
definitely.
I just go on really long mountain bike rides, Chris. I get lost. I bring a water purifying straw with me and get lost in the mountains and just drink from creeks and ride for as long as I can. It's awesome.
I did one of those with Jonathan. We ended up like walking our bikes up a 20% grade. He actually had to come back and grab my bike for me. It's like I couldn't walk it with my cycling shoes.
It looked like we got in a fight with a herd of cats after emerging from that little canyon. We had so many scratches all over us, but it was good. It's good fun. The next question is from Twitter again. We'll have a lot of these today. Remember, you can submit those to us just with the hashtag AskTrainerRoad, and then we'll scour the interwebs for it and pull it up. So this is from Crease09. He says, after today's workout, Morgan, I increased my heart rate max by 12 beats. Should I be proud or scared?
you probably didn't actually increase it. You just exploited it. So you pushed yourself to a higher level of output than you have before. The fact is you're probably learning to work harder. So you're probably actually learning to push yourself more towards your actual limits rather than the perceived limits that you've been maybe touching in the past. So it's nothing I would nothing I'd be afraid of. Pat yourself on the back and recognize that you're actually learning to really push yourself.
Yes. Todd, he says, the idea of a week-long overload followed by a week, and he's talking about overload in terms of training stress, I assume, by a week or more of recovery has been shown to produce some adaptations similar to that possible with 6 weeks of lower intensity training. This seems ideal to carry out in the week before a family vacation. Nate, you just had a family vacation.
Yeah, and this is a very timely question.
It's germane, yeah.
Yeah. He says, what specific trainer row workouts could be assembled for a 6 to 8 day fatigue week? And he has that in quotes, fatigue week. So really, he's just talking about a heavy week, a big load of training, as described in the June 2016 issue of Vela News.
Yeah, so Todd, Trevor Connor, who writes for Vela News, for whatever reason, me and him seem to be on the same wavelength. We're interested in the same things at the same times, and I'm actually working on the training camps that we've discussed in the past, and they'll surface at some point in the future. Can't say when, but that's exactly what they are. And in this one in particular, he describes kind of an anaerobic overload week, and a severe overload where you really, really hit it hard. And then the aerobic benefits that come translate or similar to those that would take, literally six times as long, like a 6 week block of basic aerobic endurance building. And it's super interesting stuff. Scientifically, it makes sense. There's plenty of research to back it up. The issue comes in just how much stress you can handle. I mean, I personally did a block, tried it out. I was shooting for 7 days. I made it 4 days in. Fifth day was outright sick. Felt like I was getting the cold that was circulating around the office. So, I found my breaking point. And that's all good and fine. And it's interesting for me on a personal level. And I can tweak that and figure out how to, maximize that particular type of training and the necessary recovery that follows. What I'd be most concerned with is doing something like this prior to a vacation and going into that vacation completely wasted. I know Nate just went to Disneyland with his family, and I can only imagine how unpleasant that would have been if he had to, follow his kids around the park, which is what would have happened with this level of fatigue had he done something like this heading into it.
Yeah. If I was going to go to Hawaii and relax on the beach, 100%, I would do that. Disneyland is its own beast. My wife one day,
you had to train for Disneyland.
Well, we got a membership at 24-Hour Fitness so we could work out where we were there. She ran 9 miles one day, and then her Apple Watch said, and who knows how accurate it is, but it said she went 20 miles that day. And it's funny, she actually, the Apple Watch underestimated her distance on the treadmill too. So in general, yeah, that just if your vacation's a real relaxation vacation, I totally think this would be cool. And we've talked about that before. One thing too with training camps, just to set everyone's expectations. I've said before, right now we're really focused on getting Android and Mac out. One thing, and this is just off the top of my head, we could chat after you develop them. We could just do a blog post at first, so people could have the information of the plans before we make a highly structured, I pick this training camp and I execute it.
Yeah, that's a great idea, because these are actually, I'd love to just answer your question, Todd, but it's really complex. It all depends on what you're addressing and what physiological adaptation you're seeking. And I mean, your level of experience, how much abuse you can actually take. There's a lot to be considered. I can't just give you one straightforward answer. And in the case of Trevor's article in Vela News, that's one approach, and it might work for some people. Didn't work all that well for me. I do believe that I'm going to, some benefits will manifest over the next couple of weeks for sure. But that's just one particular way to address one particular adaptation. You got to just determine, what weaknesses or what you're trying to get out of it, what you can put into it. Can you realistically recover following, because the recovery period is imperative. It's so important. And frankly, I found it to be the hardest part of the whole scenario.
One thing you could do too, until we get the training camp stuff out, is if you have a vacation coming up and you want to do a big block, is do 8DC. Mm-hmm. So we have two, ATC 2014 and ATC 2015. And what they are is like a simulated what you would do if you did an 8-day stage race. And it's hard, but it's doable. And I actually note a lot of people have noticed big FTP gains after they did that. It's very hard though. So, but you just check it out. If you go in our workout library and search 8DC, you'll see them. It's kind of fun because you follow the storyline of if you were in a race and different stuff happens. It's a lot more different than our regular workouts.
And Todd, you could just jump up to a higher volume version of whichever training plan you're on. So if you're on lower mid, you know, do the mid or high depending. But just what you're looking for is more work than your body is accustomed to. Banking on the guarantee that you're going to have a fair amount of recovery following. So, and that again calls in to play the nature of your vacation. If it's truly relaxing, then go ahead, you know, just destroy yourself knowing that you're going to have nothing but time to absorb all that stress and bounce back from it. But if you're going into a vacation that requires any amount of physical activity, maybe even some stress, some mountain bike riding, I mean, something that's in line with what your interests are, then it might not be the best idea to go into it completely hammered.
Sai has another question from Twitter. This one, Nate, I think you'll be able to provide some insight on. He says, I'm finally training with Power now, but as an Android user, I'm still waiting for Trainer Road. What can I do for structure until you release? And he's talking about structure in his training.
Yeah, so all you can do is use, if you're an Android user, is Mac or PC. Most people have one of those. You can use that, but we are totally on Android. So another update on Android, we've built like all the parts, so the device layer, the UI, the back end, and right now we're gluing everything together. How software goes is normally there's building all the individual parts. That takes a long time. Gluing goes really fast, and then the last part of it is fixing all the problems that you didn't know until you put everything together. And that part, you never know how long that's going to take. Because this is code that is now in our iOS, PC, and we're pretty far along in our Mac app too. There'll be less of those, but it's hard for me to give it an exact timeline, but we are looking for, the goal of the team is like early fall so that people can use it for an entire indoor training season if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. Aussies, yep. I'm sorry. You can use it in the summer for some weekday interval workouts.
Yeah, and I've noticed that Aussies actually stay on, or they train more throughout the year. I think it's maybe because they have, their, our summer is their winter, they're training then, but then when it flips around, they're training because everyone else in the Northern Hemisphere, and that's where all the news comes from, is training, and they're all talking about it. So it seems like they still train. So they're just really fast down under. So I think that's the conclusion. Sylvester. So this one, and then Jason has another question. These ones are related. So I will answer this first one just very shortly, and then we'll get into kind of the details about this later on. But he says, Sylvester says, it took me 77 workouts to finally fail an interval. And when he says fail, he means that he had to pause and adjust his, in this case, he actually dropped the intensity of the interval to finish it out there. And then he asks, how often do you guys fail? So really quick, between us three, have you had to turn down the intensity on a workout in the past month?
I have. Sylvester, I'm probably the worst guy to ask because I'm always trying to, I'm experimenting with workouts a lot. So I'll tell you, I fail quite often. And I don't like necessarily to use the term fail, but yeah, I've had to down adjust the intensity, skip an interval, backpedal, et cetera, frequently.
Nate?
I backpedaled yesterday.
Me too.
10 seconds.
Me too.
I would count the same workout.
I would count to 10 and then think, is that really 10 already? And then I would get back into it.
But 10 was all I needed, which was nice. He, I would say on his workout on Donner, looking at it, he quote unquote blew up.
Yeah, I think like, he just ran out of gas.
Yeah, because it was, so Donner is 3 by 15, right?
Looks like it.
2 by 12, something like that. It's longer intervals anyways, and there's 3 of them, and the last one is probably about a little, maybe 60% the power of the other intervals. So he started, and then he was just like, nope, this isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So
yeah, just cracked.
Kind of, yeah.
Exactly. And that could just be running out of energy. Maybe you just ran out of sugar, and you couldn't push any harder. And that's really common with workouts of this nature. You're burning a lot of glycogen, working at a pretty high percentage of FTP and holding it for a long time. So chances are you went into it a little underfueled. Maybe you could have benefited from on-the-bike fueling. A couple gulps of an energy drink or something would have gotten you through that last
blueberry
interval.
Blueberry pie?
Yeah, that'll do it. Pie. I have direct experience with that. It works really, really well. But that's what I'm guessing, because the way he rode the first 2 intervals, he looked super strong, and then the wind just went out of his sails. So probably just ran out of sugar.
Mm. So Jason, let's get into Jason's question because it has to do with the same exact thing. He says, I've been using Trainer Road since November and I love it. I just encountered my first failed workout since using Trainer Road. And by the way, once again, like Chad said, I'm not too keen on the word failed. I think and I don't think that it's just semantics. Tweaked, adjusted. Yeah, exactly. He says, I'm sorry for the long email, but I'm trying to be thorough. I'm on week 7 of the build phase, and I failed on my first workout of the week, which was Morgan. Interesting that we see that. So.
Which, by the way, Morgan's a VO2 max workout. So these are 3-minute efforts separated by 3-minute recoveries all the way up at 120%, which if you've not done VO2 max work, riding at 120% for two minutes, but little about 3 minutes is pretty brutal.
And Morgan 2 is one of the harder workouts on the entire site. Mm-hmm. It's 0.94 IF, so you got to be sharp.
Very motivated.
Yeah. And that was the reason for my snicker there, Jason, because I've been in your shoes before with Morgan. So he says, I think I failed for reasons I can explain, but I am not 100% sure. I've been using the mid-volume plan because I can handle 6 days a week, but I only chose 5 days because that gave me a day to, and he says in quotes, just ride, which is a solid plan. Good stuff. So he says, so I did a hard, longer workout the day before of just over 2 hours, which was my planned day off, according to the Trainer Road training plan. Setting himself up. And he says, so the reason I rode was because life happened and I felt bad that I missed my long ride on Sunday. I went into Morgan knowing this is my enemy as a Cat 2 mountain biker. These are the efforts I do not excel in. Which, to be clear too, Jason's from the East Coast here. And in the West Coast, we have pretty sustained, consistent climbs that tend to be a little longer or even longer than that. But in the East Coast, unless you're in Florida, but in the East Coast, it's a lot of really short and steep, hard climbs. So he says, I wanted to succeed, but I just felt horrible from interval one on. I made it to 1 minute in, I made it 1 minute into the fifth interval. I felt horrible, and then I should shut it down. I just felt super weak, and I was unable to hold the power anywhere close to the target on the fifth interval. I already had to change from sitting to standing on the third to fourth interval. So my questions are, number one, was it okay to switch from sitting to standing? What do you say about that, Chad? Because that's one thing that I see a lot of people do when things get tough. I mean, you can intentionally be, it's not that standing is bad, that you can use that with intent, but.
Yeah, this all goes to specificity. So if you're constantly resorting to getting out of the saddle to finish intervals, something's up if you have to do it frequently. If you have to do it occasionally, I wouldn't think twice about it. It's just something that influenced one workout, no big deal. And then also if you have to actually do this, if this is going to be part of the way you race, if you get out of the saddle to hit those harder climbs, then there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. In fact, absolutely incorporate that into your training, knowing that those are the exact demands you're going to face out there. Definitely want to practice them indoors.
Mm. Yeah, because he asked, did I ruin my intervals by doing what is naturally harder by standing to generate power for the time allotted? In other words, kind of like the question of like, even though it's the same watts, or is it the same standing as it is sitting?
Right. So maybe it takes a little bit of a higher muscular toll on you, right? You're using more muscle mass, you're out of the saddle, but that's basically what standing's for. And sometimes we stand just to stretch, sometimes just to break up intervals or break up long rides, long climbs, and that's all good and fine. But typically you stand because you're trying to generate more power. So again, I don't find anything wrong with that. With that said, if you're doing it frequently, if it's changing the nature of the interval, pushing you into cadences you're not going to apply outdoors, then you want to limit how often you do that.
So the next question, and this resonates with all of us that he has, because whenever we, once again, we use this word fail with air quotes here, but we feel bad. He says, do I need to do this workout again and somehow fit it in or redo the whole week? You're hard on yourself, Jason.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute too. Absolutely not. You had one workout that wasn't quite what it was meant to be. Put it behind you and move on to what's next. It sounds like you got something out of this workout. It wasn't a total wasted day. You carried a lot of fatigue into it in the first place. So perhaps next time, recognize earlier in the workout, I'm too tired for this workout. Do something else. Postpone that when you can come back and make it a little more productive. But you don't need to redo it. You're already pretty cooked. And you're probably going to see a similar version of this workout next week or in the near future, and at which time don't go into it quite so tired and set your expectations a bit higher.
So on this workout, it's 8 3-minute VO2 max intervals at 120% with 3-minute recoveries in between.
It's 8 or 6.
Put at the eight.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a big boy. Okay.
It's a big boy. Yeah. So what if on the fifth interval, and this is what I do sometimes, is if I like in the middle of it, and especially if the next day is going to be a rest day or something very easy, I'll just easy pedal that fifth interval.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll get a total of 9 minutes of rest, and then I can nail those last three.
Yeah, and this, you know what I mean? Exactly.
Like, instead of bailing.
This is what I wanted to address with Jason's approach in general. He's pretty demanding of himself. There's not a lot of flexibility in this, and you have to understand you don't have to get it right 100% of the time. I shoot for in just like a blanket 90%. If I can follow my training plan 90%, I feel pretty good about it. If I can nail the workout 90%, if I can do 90% of my long ride, all of those things get me into a level of accomplishment that's sufficient. I'm going to see all the training adaptations I'm looking for. It allows me some flexibility so I don't have to be so hard on myself. And the same thing goes with this workout. You know, maybe you remove one of those intervals and that's enough rest, enough reduction in the intensity or the overall volume of the workout to make the remainder of it productive. So you don't have to get it completely right all the time.
Yeah. Jason, you mentioned the fact that you had, you know, stress from other aspects of your life coming into it and low on rest, low on a bunch of things. You've considered all that stuff and just chalk that result up to that and then continue on. You'll carry on just fine. Don't be too hard on yourself.
Morgan's like, it's like the world champions indoor TR workouts. It's very hard. So if you don't come into it top notch, you're going to have to skip something or backpedal in the middle of an interval.
And that 120%, this is more specific to VO2 max intervals, but that 120% might not be achievable for all athletes. I mean, working at 120% of threshold doesn't just mean you're operating at the height of your VO2 peak or your VO2 max. That might be a little overshooting it. You might be more anaerobic than is intended, which means you are going to burn out sooner. So you might approach that same workout or similar intervals starting at something like 115 or even 118 if you just need a small reduction and then seeing how that goes. But the net effect, what we're after, is still going to happen even with a little bit of a reduction in the workout intensity.
And I'm going to correct it, Chad. The first two intervals in that 8-interval set,
they ramp up,
are a little bit lower than, exactly. They ramp up a little bit.
Yeah, so, and that's purposeful. That's you know, one thing to get you kind of braced for it and kind of ease you into it, but it's also to give you an idea of what you're up against. Those first couple intervals at that slightly reduced intensity, they might show you, wow, this is about all I'm going to be able to do if I'm going to do this 3 minutes time and time again. If you're not going to sail through any of those, but if you get through those pretty successfully, that's when you try the next harder one. And then that's when you settle in at 120% confident that you can eke out a few of those. But those first couple might be very telling. They might show you that, no, this is going to be enough. This is going to push me to the height of what I can hold on to for a few minutes at a time.
The other thing too, I noticed yesterday, and what was that ride we did yesterday, Jonathan?
Gould?
Yeah. I noticed, and I thought about this, is don't try to figure out what you're going to do for the rest of your workout at the end of your last interval. Because at the end of every interval, like, the workout's over. I can't do anymore, right? I put 3 minutes of rest, and it's like, okay, I can do more. But so don't make any decisions while you're in this crazy mental state. It's
I put a fair amount of that in the workout text. As soon as you come off of one of those 3-minute efforts, for instance, it's all about just keep your legs turning for a minute or two, make decisions later. But you make those decisions right now and your workout's done. No one wants to continue after something like that.
Yeah. And Jason ends and he says, I love your product and where can I buy a Trainer Road set of bibs and jersey? You shouldn't be able to buy a single one right now. If you can, let us know because somebody else is making them. But we do have plans to get some stuff going, but I don't know if we'll ever sell them. It's actually a little more complex than it sounds. Not the kit design, not anything else like that, but having to deal with all the tax stuff, Nate, can be kind of a hassle with selling stuff like a retail store in addition to what we do. So.
What I struggle with is having a place where I don't want to do group buys where I'm like, everyone, go buy it now. And I don't want to hold inventory here at Trainer Road. So I want what's called drop shipping and I don't want to deal with a store, and I don't want to deal with returns, and I don't want to deal with support for jerseys too, because that all of those things pull us out of the core of like making people faster. But I would, you know what I mean? I would love though to have, you know, everyone riding sweet, probably Quarry.
Yeah, and Quarry does do drop shipping. They have what we need to do that, but
There's can you buy them though one at a time?
You
have to do a group, right?
Yeah, people can buy them one at a time and they can get them sent to their door. They don't have to go to us. But so they have some really cool stuff set up there. But just the same, I think that what you said, Nate, about the focus, this is tooting our own horn, but we are a very, very, very focused group of people here. So we're always working on whatever our domain demands us to, and we're very focused on that. So it would still pull us out. But yeah, Jason, stay tuned. Thing. Yeah, stay tuned. We might have something. Who knows? We'd love to.
Yeah. I struggle with it because I would so love to see a train road kit in the wild.
It'd be awesome, right? And you may have seen a few of them, and it's just between us employees, we have some, but that's pretty much it. So, or like on our custom kits that we have. But hi, his question, that's his name. He's from Twitter. He says, "Hey guys, what are the pros and cons of 26-inch, 27.5-inch, and 29-inch mountain bike wheels? How would you modify your answer for East Coast cross country versus trail?" So there's a lot of marketing about this, high with like 26-inch wheels or though that was the gold standard. And then we're talking about the diameter of the wheel. Then 29-inch came along and everyone called them wagon wheels, made fun of them, said you were riding a penny farthing and you looked ridiculous. And at first the bikes didn't handle well because they hadn't optimized the frame's geometry to the wheels. And then 27.5 came along. It's like the perfect, you know, nice in the middle slot. And it's a good compromise of the two. The thing is, by now, pretty much every brand or established brand or any type of boutique but known brand, if they're going to make a bike with one of those wheel sizes, they're going to be making it with a proper geometry so that it's not like a clown bike for a 29er or a kid's bike for a 26 or something like that. So it'll be all matched to it. And despite what marketing will tell you, if you're a small person, that doesn't mean that you need 26-inch small wheels. If you're a big person, that doesn't mean you need big wheels like a 29. Really, it comes down to preference. So if you're used to riding bicycles and that traditional bicycle feel where it's a little more responsive and even, I would say, twitchy, but if you're used to that, then 26-inch or 27.5-inch, you'll probably feel right at home. 29 has a different feel, carries more momentum. Myself, coming from a lifetime of racing motocross, I love that greater inertia, that feel, and kind of that mass to work against a little more. We use so much body English in motorcycle racing that when I ride a 29, I can use more body English and I don't turn myself backwards, upside down, and on my head quite so easily. So that's what I would say. Chad, you went from 26 to 27.5 recently. Did you notice a difference? Because I honestly don't notice much of a difference between 26 and 27.5.
Yeah, I noticed a big difference, but I can't attribute it to wheel size. I've been out of the mountain biking realm for long enough that disc brakes are a difference. The improvements in suspension and lockout, dropper posts, they're better tire compounds
and
lower
Chad.
Pressure. I know. And tubeless tires. I mean, there were so many things that improved my whole ride experience that I can't attribute it to any one of them. So I can't really say.
So one thing too with between 29 and 26 is it'll roll over bumps better, and that's mm-hmm. because the angle that it actually hits bumps is going to be different because of the bigger diameter wheel. So just the physics thing is that it'll roll over those bumps easier, and it'll be harder to spin up though. I recently rode a 20. I've been riding 29 and a fat bike. And I rode a 26-inch bike, and it felt like squirrely and twitchy. But some people really like that. Like, if they so in cross country, Jonathan, pretty much most of the pros use 29, right?
Yeah, the majority.
And with
a few
27.5.
Yeah, a few 27.5, and pretty much 0.26.
And then for trail, it's probably 29 and 27.5, right?
Certainly. And then once you get into like enduro, it's more 27.5. Very, very rare 26 and some 29. And then when you get to downhill, which is the most down-oriented, it's almost all 26 and 27.5. Pretty much no 29. It's very rare.
And it's weird because, you know, I just said that the 29 hits bumps better, but on downhill, you have so much travel that's going to take up all the bumps. And mm-hmm. I'm guessing, Jonathan, they take the 26 because they need to be extremely precise in their handling.
Exactly.
Or else
they want it to be
really
agile.
Really bad time. Yeah.
Yep. Really agile. Really, it just comes down to a preference thing. And if you can demo as many bikes as you can, 29ers, the frame tends to sit in between the wheels, Whereas a 26 or even some 27.5s, the frame seems to sit more on top of the wheels. You're going to have a slightly longer wheelbase with the 29, but they'll counter for that and they'll make it feel like it's handling really quickly in a lot of ways. So a good bike with proper geometry, it's going to handle well no matter what wheel size you have on. It just really comes down to what you like in the feel of a bike. If you like something that keeps more momentum, rolls over things easier, and kind of has some inertia to push against and everything else and empty, then the 29 is good. If you like something that's a little more agile, 27.5. The only reason I'd advocate against 26, unless you're a downhill rider, which it doesn't look like you are by the last part of the question, but it's because it's harder to find 26-inch stuff now. It's kind of dying out in terms of the industry and products. So harder to find tires, wheels, that type of a thing. So, and the one thing you say hi is in the context of East Coast XC and trail. To give you an idea, I think the average speed last year of the winner of national champs in Mammoth, which is totally different than East Coast, but in Mammoth was like 13.8 or like pretty much 14 miles an hour, which is pretty fast for a cross country course. Then the last time they had it back east, I looked at it and I think it was 7. So like wow. Half the speed. You're dealing with roots, slippery stuff, a lot of rock, a lot of tight, twisty and steep little undulations, not these big, fast downhills and big, long uphills. So because of that, you get to pick. If you want a more agile bike, then 27.5 is definitely where you want to go to dodge in and out of those roots. But you'll have a lot of things that could kind of stop you when you're rolling and halt your momentum. And 29 will certainly help. I know I would pick 29, especially back east, but that's my personal pick.
And the new thing they have is 650B plus, or like Specialized calls it 650, which is a 27.5, but with a mid fat tire. I think that diameter, it gives you the diameter of a 29 inch tire, but a little more width and traction, which is kind of cool, especially if you're, it could be a cool, like a fun trail bike, you know, with occasional racing. But I think the biggest point is if you can demo them, because I think a 27.5 can feel better than a 29, and a 29 can feel better than a 27.5, depending on the bike and the components and the setup. That's like probably the majority of things. Each bike has such, you know, the slack angle and the chainstay length. It's huge.
Yeah, makes a big difference. So ride as many as you can, see what you like, and then pick it. We're going to end with one last question here from Jens. I hope it's Jens, not Jens, but Jens on Twitter says, I noticed my resting heart rate has dropped from 61 to 47 since beginning cycling 2 years ago. What benefits are there to a low HR?
Yeah, so Jens, this is just an indication of how your body has adapted to training and riding your bike. The fact is your heart's gotten stronger, probably a little thicker, a little tougher, but basically it's gotten buff. It's capable of pushing more blood for every heart rate. So you've increased what's called your stroke volume or your cardiac output. In any case, you are capable of delivering more oxygen to the muscle, and therefore, you know, assuming your muscles are conditioned and your circulatory system has adapted along with these central adaptations, you can do more work per heartbeat. So you've basically gotten fitter. Your heart's stronger than it was.
I'm looking at a Harvard study where it says slower heart rate may translate to longer life, reports from Harvard. That's probably correlation, is the causation is probably the working out, and that causes you to have a lower heart rate. That's what I'm guessing, but there is a correlation between lower heart rate and longer living, just like low body fat and
excellent
blood pressure.
So I'm totally,
all the things you get from cycling.
I'm totally going to outlive Nate then. So I may be old, but I'm going to be around for longer than he is.
No, my resting, dude, my resting can get down to like, I have a huge range. When I'm fit, my resting would be like 37, 36.
Okay, me too.
And then go up to like 202.
Yikes.
What's your resting, Chad?
In the high 30s, but when I work at, you know, like threshold, I can sit at 340, 350 watts at, you know, 160 BPM. So it never gets that high. In fact, I don't remember last time I touched 170.
I was hitting 190 yesterday.
Yeah, I think my current max that I've seen in the past 12 months is 192. Oof. Was the highest I've seen.
That would kill me.
And my resting is high 30s too. So I think John Tomax was like 12. That's probably an over exaggeration, but that guy was insane. So He was known for having like one of the I've got to look up what it is, 12? But he's known for having one of the lowest resting heart rates.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, I'm sure 12 isn't accurate. It's probably lore at this point, but.
Donk.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a big heart.
Yeah, but yeah, at that point we can just Cool. All right, so let's wrap it up there. That's enough this week. We've got a lot of questions, and we go through, by the way, as many questions as we get. We go through as many as we can, sort through, and try to pick some that are interesting and have the widest application. But please submit your questions. Keep going. We get plenty of them, and we look through all of them. So you can submit them once again. Just go to trainerroad.com/podcast or use the hashtag AskTrainerRoad on Twitter or Instagram. Or just find us on Snapchat. Shoot us a snap, and we can either answer your question right then and there, or we can bring it up on this podcast and answer it there too. You can find this podcast on Stitcher, iTunes, SoundCloud. You can rate and share from there. Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.